For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Coming up on today's show, I'll be on stage at the Edinburgh International Book Festival with author and actor John Gordon Sinclair. We've got The Books of Your Life from Bernardine Evaristo. And in a moment, Red Sail will be talking to Joseph Coyle. Last week on the show, we featured Cresta Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon and the former Children's Laureate. That position has now been filled by someone else. So here's Red Sail.
Joseph Coelho is a prize-winning poet, playwright and author, and an old friend of Read On. And now he's been appointed the new Children's Laureate, taking over from How to Train Your Dragon author Cressida Cowell. It's a role he feels passionate about, and he's got a three-point plan for the next 2 years, as he told me when I rang him up.
Joe, many congratulations.
Thank you, Ed. It was a real shock and a real pleasure, and I can't wait to get started.
The laureateship is managed by the Book Trust charity and sponsored by Waterstones, and it was set up in 1999 when Quentin Blake was the first Children's Laureate, and other previous laureates include Mallory Blackman, Jacqueline Wilson and Chris Riddell. You've got some pretty big boots to fill.
Well, I've got quite big feet. But yeah, no, it's a complete pleasure to be joining the ranks of the League of Laureates, and they've been so supportive and given me advice on this run-up to starting the laureateship. So one that was kind of consistent amongst many of the past laureates I spoke to was to book your holidays early, because you get really, really busy, and it's only been, I'm only into my second week, I've already experienced just how busy it can get. But I'm loving it and can't wait to get started on all my key projects for my tenure.
Well, we'll come on to talk about the projects in just a sec, but what did Cressida Cowell say to you as she handed over your laureate's medal about how to manage your laureateship?
She told me to enjoy it and to have a lot of fun with it, because it can be quite, you know, it's a huge honour, and it's something, you know, we all take very seriously, and it's a great honour to be representing children's literature and to getting books into the hands of children, but to remember to enjoy the process and to celebrate that process. So yeah, that was nice words to hear, actually, because it's, you know, it's a big job and a huge undertaking, but something that I'm going to approach with relish.
And you're taking it very seriously. You've announced that you've got a three-point plan, starting with making poetry accessible to everybody, something to celebrate self-expression rather than just be studied in the classroom.
Yeah, and like, don't get me wrong, I love studying poetry in the classroom. I think we should study poetry, but what often gets forgotten is just the joy of poetry, the fact that we are all poets, that we can put pen to paper and pen a little ditty or a haiku or even a one-word poem. So often poetry is only represented as something that is there to be studied, to be analysed, and we're told there's a correct way of analysing a poem and a wrong way and a correct answer to a poem and an incorrect analysis of a poem, when really poetry is very subjective. And by showing young people that we can be poets, that we are all poets as well as readers of poetry, you can start to break down those barriers and open up poetry and reveal it for what it really is, which is this joyful medium which can help us navigate good times, bad times. That's why we reach for poems at funerals and new births and weddings, or, you know, times of difficulty, because a poet transcends. It speaks to those parts of us we often find hard to put into words, ironically.
As you say, it captures that moment and encapsulates it into something, well, small and beautiful as well.
Yeah, I think that's one of the benefits of poetry, because the medium tends to be small. I mean, there are, you know, very long ballad poems, like the Mahabharata, I think, is the longest poem of several million words. But on the whole, poetry tends to be a shorter medium than most of its cousins. And in a bite-sized world, the bite-sized world that we're in, it lends itself to that quick snippet of crystallizing a moment in time, of summing up an idea or an emotion or a feeling. But because there are layers within poetry, you can get that first hit, but then you go back and you uncover more and more and more, and you realize the depth of a poem and how a poem can leave you wondering and thinking for days, weeks, months, years.
And poetry is also there to be spoken out loud. It is the perfect piece of self-expression in that respect too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find it's a real shame when we forget that. We get the word lyrics because in ancient Greece, poems or spoken word were read to the tune of the lyre, of the stringed musical instrument. And that's why we have the word lyrics. And we sort of separate and box songs, rap, spoken word into all these different areas. But actually, they all come from that same heart of putting words up on their feet, bringing words to life, be it with performance or music or rhythm, or, you know, thinking about audience and stage and space and how those elements all come together. Of course, you can just read a poem on the page, and that's absolutely fine and valid, and we should keep doing that. But we shouldn't neglect the performance aspects, or indeed neglect the fact that we can put pen to paper ourselves.
Now, the second part of your three-point plan is called Bookmaker Like You, and that is about celebrating diversity in publishing.
Yeah, I really wanted to ensure that every young person gets to see themselves in a bookmaker. So I'll be searching for those new up-and-coming voices in poetry, novels, plays, on the front line and behind the scenes, so publishers, editors, agents, and talking to them and celebrating their work and finding out what it is that they do, what their processes are about, and sharing that with young people so that they can have that opportunity to think, I could do that, that could be me. Because that was hugely important to me growing up. I didn't realize for a very long time during my schooling that I could be a writer. I never saw anyone who looked like me who was a writer until Jean Binterbreeze visited my school, the wonderful late great Jean Binterbreeze, who was an amazing poet from the Caribbean, came to my school, sat on our school stage and read a poem about the softest touch. And it was from that moment that I realized, this is a job that people do, and there's someone who looks a bit like me doing it. And it started to broaden my horizons and make me realize, that could be me. And then there were other instances as I got older, doing courses at Apples and Snakes, the performance poetry organization, and meeting wonderful poets like Francesca Beard and Aoife Mannix and Jacob Sam LaRose and Lem Sisse, and seeing these working poets creating shows and sharing their work, which just underlined the fact that I could be a writer. That could be my job. There are people that I recognized doing that as a career. So I really want to give that gift to every young person so that everyone gets to see themselves.
And the third part of your plan, which will come as no surprise to anyone who's heard you talking on Read On in the past, is your love of libraries.
Yeah. I started a library marathon pre-COVID where I gave myself the challenge of joining a library in every library authority in the UK, and then discovered there are 209 library authorities. But it didn't put me off. I ended up joining 140 libraries. And the point was to meet the library staff, to borrow books, to highlight the authors and illustrators and the work that I was borrowing from those libraries. I was blogging about my experience and encouraging people to get down to their local library. Then COVID hit and I had to stop. But what's great now is I have about 70 odd left to join, with a few extra thrown in for good measure. And I'll be joining them as laureate, and I'll be blogging about my process and about my experiences, borrowing books, highlighting the authors and illustrators that I borrow, meeting with library staff, reading stories and poems at those libraries. So encouraging families through the door, and hopefully getting the whole nation celebrating their libraries. And if they're not already a member, becoming a member. And if they are already a member, getting far more books out.
Well, one place where I know that many of our listeners get their books from is the RNIB Library, which has a great selection of your books, including your Fairy Tales Gone Bad series, which you narrate yourself. Sounds like you were having great fun reading those.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was lovely to narrate them. So I've narrated Zombirella and the latest one, Frankenstiltskin. And I'm due to narrate the next one, Creeping Beauty, which comes out this October. The idea for the series came about because I was touring children's plays that I had written and produced around libraries and theatres and schools for about 4 years. And one of the plays I was touring was called Zombirella, which was a play I'd written about Cinderella, but she falls down the stairs and dies and gets turned into a zombie. So it already kind of existed as a performance piece. So when I was asked to read the book, you know, for the audio version, it was a complete delight. I got to redo the play, to do all the voices and to have a great deal of fun bringing it to life for the audio setting.
And what else are you working on at the moment? Or don't you have any time to pick up a pen now that you have become Children's Laureate?
Oh, no, I wholly expect to be writing throughout my 2 years. I feel it's important to be sharing with people my process as a writer, that I am a working writer. I have books that need to be written. So at the moment, I'm working on a new poetry collection, which is a follow up to Poems Aloud and Smile Out Loud, with Daniel Gray Barnett illustrating. So I'm finishing off that collection. I'm working on a new, quite exciting adventure middle grade series, which will be coming out next year, which I can't say too much about. And I've just finished The Boy Lost in the Maze, which is a kind of a follow-up, although it's a different story. It's a follow-up to The Girl Who Became a Tree, which was my first YA. I call it a story told in poems. So it's like a verse novel, but they are a mix of free verse and structured poems that in this case tell the story of a boy searching for his biological father. And that story is interlinked with the six labours of Theseus in ancient Greece and the story of the Minotaur. So these three boys, Theseus, Theo, and the Minotaur, all three of them are on their own journeys, discovering what it means to be a man, what manhood is all about, kind of unpicking that. And it's like a magical realist narrative told through poems.
And I believe that you wrote a poem to celebrate your appointment as the Children's Laureate. Would you be able to share that with us now?
Yes, I will. It's called The Power of a Poem. And it goes like this. A poem has the power to build the highest tower, to paint the prettiest flower. A poem has the power. In that tower of flowers, you may find a blooming power. As you paint with pollen and petal, you'll find a rose can test your mettle. A poem has the skill to cure any ill, turn thoughts to windmills. A poem has the skill. As new ideas spin, the problems they're curing will waft away with time because of a little rhyme. A poem has the capability to conquer all hostility, to play a song of tranquility. A poem has the capability. Words can hurt and soothe, but you'll make the spiky smooth. Apply a sentence like a balm. Use a poem to heal and calm. A poem has the might to give your passion bite, to let your words take flight. A poem has the might. Your words might change a mind, inspire someone to be kind, or your words might roar with the bite of a dinosaur.
Joseph Coelho, our new Children's Laureate, thank you so much for coming onto the show to tell us a little bit more about your three-pronged plan, and I will hope to see you either in a library or at a book event soon.
I hope so, Red. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
The RNIB has a selection of Joseph Coelho's books, including Fairy Tales Gone Wrong, that Joe narrates himself. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community,
from remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
John Gordon Sinclair was born in Glasgow and became involved with the city's youth theatre when he was 15. Whilst there, the film director Bill Forsyth cast him and several others in his 1981 production Gregory's Girl. He went on to star in other films directed by Forsyth, including Local Hero. He's also worked on stage and TV, appearing in a lead role in John Byrne's TV series Your Cheating Heart, and in 1995 he was awarded the Laurence Olivier Award. But amongst his stage work and work on the small and big screen, he's also a novelist. His first novel, 70x7, was published in 2012 and was followed by Blood Whispers, then Walk in Silence. The audio version of his second book, Blood Whispers, was produced by RNIB Scotland, and it was launched at an event in front of an invited audience at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. So live on stage, I asked John Gordon Sinclair about his book, Blood Whispers.
Well, it's the follow-up to my first book was called 70x7, which was set in the early 90s, and this is a kind of follow-up to it, a very loose follow-up to it. There's a minor character in the first book called Keira Lynch, who is trying to escape from her past, and her mother and grandmother bring her over to live in Glasgow, or they did in the early 90s, and she is now... The Blood Whispers are set in the present day. It's set in 2014, mm-hmm. and she's living in Glasgow, and she's a lawyer. She works as a criminal lawyer. The events, things that have happened to her, if you read the first book, you'll understand what happened to her when she was younger, when she was an eight-year-old kid, and it informs who she is, who her character is, and why she's become a lawyer and trying to help people. But you don't have to have read the first book.
Yeah, I asked you that before. You don't have to have read the first book to enjoy the second one. It's standalone.
It's a standalone book, really. And she's a lawyer. She gets involved with this young girl who's been trafficked into the country and working as a prostitute. And in her dealings with her, she becomes involved with the Serbian mafia. She gets involved with the CIA. And her life kind of spirals out of control. Mm.
I will warn you, though, reading the second one will make you want to read the first one.
Well, that's a good thing. Thank you for that. So that's a brief outline. That's a very brief outline of the book.
Your background is acting. Do you think that helped with the cinematic feel of the book?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm here. We'll probably come on to that and you're going to ask me this, but now that you've brought that up, it's one of the reasons I'm here actually today, because when I was asked about this and doing the thing for the Royal National Institute, it started raising questions in my mind, because when I write a book, what I'm trying to do is describe a film that's going on in my head. It's a very, for me, it's a very visual process, mm-hmm. you know. And so when I was asked to do this, it made me start asking questions about how, because one of the things I'm not very good at, one of the things I don't like, is lots of descriptions of, you know, scenery and what's going on. I'm not very good at it, mm-hmm. so I prefer to spend my time telling the story through dialogue, and one of the aims I have eventually, if I ever get the chance, is to actually write a book that's kind of more or less all dialogue, and you learn the whole story through the dialogue. But when I'm writing the book, all I'm trying to do is describe the film that's going on in my head. And so I thought, actually, when I was asked to do this, I thought, well, that's kind of really interesting. I'd like to find out how, if there's a way of making that better for people who, if you can't see the image, is there a way, as a writer, I can make that better? If there's a way that I can improve that? So I'm actually here hoping to get some tips, get some hints and tips.
Same, was the first chapter a sort of experiment in that, because that is all dialogue?
Well, the first the book kicks off with a conversation between you find out that she's the main character later on, but it starts off the conversation between a woman and a psychiatrist, and it is just all dialogue. And yeah, it kind of was not so much an experiment, but I just thought there's no point. You very quickly get the image that what's going on, what this conversation is all about. Really, so I thought I don't need to sit down and describe a psychiatrist's chair or a psychiatrist's room, or you get the just the way they talk to each other, you get that pretty quickly. So I did try to, as far as possible, just to have that chapter as a conversation.
Mm. So. It's quite visceral. Do you think people were expecting that from you in particular, knowing the sort of characters you've played before?
No, I think most people would have expected me to write a light-hearted comedy, really. But that's because most people, first impressions count, and most people's first impression of me was as a kind of gangling 18-year-old, which was 30 years ago. Well, maybe a bit more than that, actually, but let's stick with 30 for the moment. But that's definitely one side of me, but it's not all of me, really. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to do was write the kind of book that I would want to take on holiday with me. Mm-hmm. And because it's a crime novel, I thought you can't come at a crime novel and make it funny. You know, it's got if there's, because a few people have commented, particularly in the first one, the second one not so much, but a few people have commented on the kind of level of violence in the first book, but. It's only one aspect of it, because for me the violence in the first book is the same as the humour in the first book, or the if you're supposed to empathise with someone. My whole thing is that if a scene's supposed to be funny, then I hope you laugh. If it's supposed to be sad, I hope you cry. If it's supposed to be violent, I hope you think, oh, actually that's too much. I don't really like that, because for me violence is like that. And similarly, in the second book, it's probably the second book. It's a female protagonist who's the main. She's the main character, and so if there were scenes where violence was involved, I was thinking, well, how would, from a female perspective, how would this pan out? Really, so it's possibly not quite as violent as the first one. But again, and here's me. I'm now talking myself into making it sound like it's really violent. It's not. As I say, if it's funny, I hope you laugh. If it's sad, I hope you cry.
I was going to give a spoiler away about weapons she uses, but I won't.
Yes, well. When I first wrote the book, it just so happened that the time that I was reading a book by Cormac McCarthy, which I don't know if anyone's read it, it's unremittingly violent. It's horrible. And I got halfway through it and I actually put it down, thought, I can't finish this, it's too much. With any book that I've ever read, I don't like doing that. I want to kind of get to the end, even if I don't enjoy it. But at least I can say I finished it. I read an interview with Cormac McCarthy where he said that he wanted to write a book that made people feel what real violence feels like. So that it's not there just as an entertainment. It's there. He wanted to get closer to how real violence feels. And when I read that, I thought it made me go back and redo some scenes in the first book. Because I thought, actually, I do want, if people read that and think, this is too much, I want to flick on to the next page, they won't miss anything in the storyline, but the effect of the violence, it will have had that effect on them. It will make them feel like, I don't really like that, because I think you shouldn't enjoy violence, really.
Is there?
Can we get off the violence?
Okay.
I feel like I've said violence about 500 times.
But is there a third on the way? A third book?
Yes, there is. Well, it's not on the way yet, but there is. Yeah, there's been but we haven't quite done the deal yet. But there's been an offer made for the third book,
right?
Which I'm quite pleased about. Actually, the second book, there's a lot of loose ends at the end of the second book, and I thought at the time when I sent it off to the publishers, I thought if they phone me back and say, look, you've got to tie off these loose ends, then I'll know that I'm not getting a deal for a third book. But if nobody calls me, then there's a chance that there's a possibility that they might want another one. So I was quite pleased when nobody phoned me.
Now, you mentioned publishers. Was it quite easy to get the first book published just because of who you are?
Well, a lot of people think that, actually, but in actual fact, it made it a little bit harder. The head of paperbacks at Faber, at the launch that we had for the book, she stood up and made this speech, which was quite funny, because she started saying, when the book first came in, she was saying, I don't want to read that. It's that actor, John Gordon Sinclair, and, it's going to be terrible. And at the time, I remember when she was at the launch, I was thinking, I'm actually standing here. why are you telling this story? It was the editor, who, a younger editor, who had no idea of, had never seen me acting or anything like that. She was reading it purely on the fact that it was a novel that had been sent into her, and it was her that persuaded her to actually, the head of paperbacks, to actually read it. So it was a close-run thing, you know. It actually almost got in the way, really.
Now, you've recently been in World War Z. At the end of World War Z, excuse me for a minute, did your character live?
No, unfortunately, just after I was killed, they announced they were doing a sequel.
So I never actually saw him being killed.
No, he just walks off the end of the end of the plane, mm-hmm. and they'd used the budget up by that point.
Right, okay.
but I remember when I first got the call about World War Z and thinking, why? Because, you know, you get a onesie. I was thinking, a World War Z? I wonder what a World War Z is. Because I hadn't, and then someone said, no, that's the American pronunciation of Z. And I'm like, all right, okay, I get you now. I hadn't quite, because I hadn't seen it written down or anything like that. I just got a phone call saying, you want to go along for this meeting for World War Z? I'm going, really? Okay.
Some of which was filmed in Glasgow, but you weren't in any of the Glasgow scenes?
No, I did. I did 5 weeks on it in total, and they did 7 weeks in the UK. Hmm. And the 2 weeks that I wasn't involved in were the 2 weeks that they were filming in Glasgow. And everyone in Glasgow was saying, I thought you said you were in this. I said, I'm just not in that bit. And they're saying, nah, you're just pulling a leg. You're not in it at all.
Now, from a member of a SWAT team to you're now playing Jeeves on stage.
I'm in the West End just now, mm-hmm. in London, doing Jeeves and Wooster. Yeah, and I'm playing Jeeves. With an English accent, because the first question everyone says to me is, oh, is this the first Scottish Jeeves? And I get a bit shirty and say, no, I am actually an actor. Do you know what I mean? I can do voices. They're not very good, but I can do them.
Now, would you say you were an actor or a writer?
I'm much more a writer. Mm. If I had the choice, if someone said to me, you can choose one or the other and never do it, other again, mm-hmm. I would choose writing, and my personality is much more suited to being a writer. I'm not I'm a bit of a sociophobe, really. I'm not very I'm generally not that happy. I'm much happier sitting in my hut at the bottom of the garden plotting ways to kill people than I am actually going to parties and standing on stage making people laugh. So
you'd rather be in your hut right now?
I'd rather be, well, not right now, obviously, but no, I'm not. I'm much more. I'd much rather be a writer. Yeah.
Now, my last question: if they made Blood Whispers into a movie, what part would you play in that? You need to have a part in it.
No, I kind of like to do the Hitchcock thing and just walk through the back of a shot or something like that. I wouldn't really like to be involved in it, really, because originally the first book I actually the first 70x7 was originally going to be a film script, and it was an idea that I'd had to do something with it. People kept mistaking me for Tim Robbins, the actor, for some reason. I kept and I was going to write a story about mistaken identity and stuff, and it evolved into becoming the novel, really. But from that point onwards, once I started writing it, I people keep saying, well, what part would you have? Mm-hmm. I say I don't really want a part in it. It's not me at all. And similarly with Blood Whispers, there's not really I'd like to just walk through the back of a shot, I think.
Now, we'll have some questions from the audience. Who's got a question?
Could I ask, when you develop the plot, do you have it completely plotted at the start, so you know exactly what you're doing?
No, I did. But the first one, I had a much better idea of where I was going with it. But I actually wrote a different ending to the first book. When I got there, I actually thought, I can't end it. I'd kind of, what I'd done is written the Hollywood ending. I don't want to ruin anyone's if you haven't read it before. But when I got there, I thought, I can't actually do that. I'm going to have to be a bit more honest with it. And so I changed the ending. And then the idea I had for the second book, once I started writing it, it kind of veered off in a whole entirely different direction. And I ended up, when I'd finished it, I thought, I've actually still got that book to write, which is now going to be the third book. So the simple answer to your question is no. I've got no idea. And it's a great thing, actually. It's a great thing to experience, because you think you've got one idea in your head, but as it evolves, it changes and morphs into something else. And that, for when I started doing that, it's a great process to go through. So I've got a rough idea of where this third book is going to go, but I'm kind of hoping that once I start writing it, it'll start taking on its own life, really.
Do you ever surprise yourself when you're writing, thinking, I didn't think that was going to happen?
There's quite a lot of things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the two biggest things for me were, though, there's some stuff that happens at the end of the first book, and when I was writing it, I started crying. And that's a weird thing, because it's in my head, and yet I'm making myself cry. But more weird than that was, I was writing a line that I knew was going to be a punchline, and when I wrote it down, I started laughing. And so I thought, so I've actually just told myself a joke, which I'd love to sit down with a psychiatrist or psychologist or something and explain that to me, because I know the punchline because it's me that's writing it, but then to read it and start laughing is a very strange experience, especially when you're sitting in a hut on your own with nobody else around, and you're either weeping or laughing at your own stuff. Weird.
Is this hut within earshot of anyone?
No, thankfully no, thankfully not.
Any more questions?
How do you combine your acting career with your writing? Does this mean that you're stuck in your huts at the bottom of the garden for yonks? How long does it take if you're doing your learning your lines, but you're also sitting...
writing.
And you're doing your writing.
Well, I know from very recent experience about this, because the deal for the third book coincided with the restart of rehearsals for the show in the West End. So I was supposed to start writing the third book in July, but that whole month was taken up with rehearsals, and the show is so exhausting that and my kids have just broken up for school. So I've got them during the day, and then I'm doing the show at night, and the rest of the time I'm trying to sleep. So at the moment, there's no writing being done. I'm supposed to have started, but it's not going to happen really now until September. So it's a little bit difficult. But what I'm hoping to do is eventually tip the balance. At the moment, it's kind of 50-50. There's 50% acting, 50% writing, but I'm hoping to tip the balance more over the years, the next couple of years, more in favour of just doing the writing. So hopefully that won't be such a concern. But I had a couple of moments when I was rehearsing where it's the closest I've ever come to it to actually, I thought, I'm going to have to tell them I need to leave now, because I kept thinking about the book and thinking that's a good idea for the book. And so I was on stage thinking I might have to just say to them, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be here. I should never have accepted this job. So if you don't mind, I'm going to leave. And I had a real struggle inside my head not to do that.
In a West End production like that, say you're 3 or 4 months into it and you're doing the same thing every night and twice on a Saturday, does it get monotonous?
It can do. I mean, this is the I'm used to doing a year's run in the West End. Over the last 30 years, I got asked quite a lot in Scotland, especially when I come up to Scotland, people say to me, have you given up acting? And I think, well, the last 30 years, I spent 10 of them doing shows in the West End, and because you're not on television, people just assume that you're not doing it. So I'm used to doing year long runs, and this run that I'm doing just now is only 3 months. So for me, this is like a walk in the park, and so far it's not been. We've been doing it for about 8 weeks now. It's not been. I haven't had that feeling. But when you're doing a year-long run, there can be nights where there's words coming out of your mouth, but actually you're doing your shopping in your head. You're like, I need to go to Tesco's after this and get some cornflakes, you know.
Again, with the writing and acting, if you had to choose stage or screen, what one would you prefer?
I don't know. I think I'd put them level pegging. Once you get up and running in a play, it's a difficult birth doing when you start a play, but once you get up and running, once you hit cruising altitude, it's quite straightforward. I quite like it, but I much prefer the precision of filming and the attention to detail, and that's what I try to put in my books as well, is try and get an attention to detail in there. So I much prefer that way of working. So, but level pegging, I would think.
Any more questions?
Do you like to write on a laptop or computer, or do you prefer to write longhand?
Definitely on a computer. I like the immediacy of it, because you can write something down and then 10 minutes later go back and alter it and change it, and it's much more easy to manipulate. But when I have ideas, I've got everything from cigarette packets to envelopes to toilet paper to the places you suddenly have an idea, you think, I've got to write that down and I'll forget it. But when I'm doing the main bulk of the writing, it's on a computer.
Is it a good or a bad thing that computer's connected to the internet?
Well, I actually find it quite good, because the access you have now with Google and Wikipedia and all these things, the access you have to information is instant, and I like that. You know, if there's so many ideas, I'm never lost for it. Or if I ever am lost for an idea, I just click onto Wikipedia, read something, or click onto Google and search something. And there's so many ideas out there that I quite like the immediacy of that.
Did you use Google Translate for the note? Which you need to apologise to the narrator for.
No, I actually got there was a proofreader who went through all that and did the proper translation for it. But I think I might have used Google Translate initially, but then it was corrected.
Is Trish here? The narrator, you had to learn, is it Serbian?
Albanian,
yeah.
Albanian. All right. So have you done it already? Have you actually done the book? Right, good. Well, do you know the funny thing is, I'm so glad it's in a female voice, because it was one of the things I was going to ask, because I didn't realise it'd actually been recorded, and it was one of the things I was going to ask today, was, is there any chance it could be in a female voice? So that's, that's fantastic news. Just put a smile on my face.
But say sorry about the Serbian.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, you know the thing that I sort of will come to you just in 2 seconds. Just on the weird thing, the very first time I came to Edinburgh, not Edinburgh, but to the book festival, was a couple of years ago for the first with the first book, and I was asked to read from the book, and it was the strangest experience, because I kept saying to the publisher, "Well, I need to read," and they said, "No, it's fine, you don't have to." And then obviously when I arrived here, they said, "Oh, what bit are you going to read?" I said, really? I thought, I'm sure you said, I didn't have to. It's the first time it struck me, because when I tried to do it, I realised that it wasn't in my voice. And it was a very, very odd thing. And now I don't like actually doing it. And the same with Blood Whispers, because they said, would you mind doing, you know, a reading for it? I said, it sounds odd, but I actually can't. It's not my voice. It needs to be. I was hoping it would be a female, so that's brilliant.
I was just wondering whether you think that in literature in general, people with disabilities or minorities are well represented, and whether it's difficult to write about people in those communities.
Well, I suppose it's one of the issues that came up when I was asked about this, because it's something that never really occurred to me before, and that's why I thought, I'm hoping when I get here today I'll learn something from it, you know, because I started looking through to see, you know, about characters in literature who were blind, and you know, there's, you know, the parables and stuff going into the Bible, but there's not really any. It was quite hard to find, people represented in that way. So it's kind of got me thinking, really, and it's also, as I said earlier, it's got me thinking about what things I can do in my writing to make, because for me it's such a visual image, is how to make that better for someone who can't see the image, you know, so it's kind of got me thinking about it quite deeply, really.
So it's important to you that your books are available in audio and
absolutely
braille.
Access. I was taken to the opera, and I say I was taken because the tickets were £150 each. And thank God I wasn't paying, because when I saw the price on the ticket, I just happened to glance at the ticket. Nobody had told me this, and I thought, I suddenly felt really uncomfortable. I thought, this is kind of almost obscene that this costs that amount of money. And I remember reading about the guy who invented. I was thinking, the reason this is such an elitist thing is because most people can't afford it. And I remember reading about the guy that started Penguin Books, and his whole thing was, he was in a train station, and all that was available were kind of cheap magazines and crappy paperbacks, and that inspired him to think, well, surely great literature should be available as well. And he started Penguin Books, and their main kind of idea was to get good literature into paperbacks and make it accessible for everyone. And I feel that's the same. Culture, art, it's what defines us as human beings. It's what makes us special, and everyone should have access to that, no matter what, really. So, I think it's really important.
You mentioned your ambition was to write a book that's mainly dialogue.
Yeah.
I wonder if you're influenced by Elmore Leonard, who's the king of dialogue, of course, in crime thrillers.
Yeah, hugely. And in fact, sometimes when I get stuck for ways to describe things, I glance at an Elmore Leonard book. Don't tell anyone that, in case someone actually points out the actual bits. But yeah, each book, in the first one, there's a couple of guys, there's a couple of characters in Alabama, a couple of criminals who met. I was trying to find somewhere where these two guys would have got together, and it just so happened, as I was searching around Google, I found this place called the Elmore Correctional Center in Alabama, which was a little nod to Elmore Leonard. And one of the guys who leaves Ireland to go to America is travelling on a false passport, and his name on the passport is Mr. Leonard. So I've got Elmore Correctional Centre, and I've got him travelling on a passport that's Mr. Leonard. And in the second book, in Blood Whispers, there's a cop in it called, I can't remember what his second name is, Matt, what's his second name? But he was a sergeant in one of the Elmore Leonard books, and he's now a detective, DCI, in my book. So which is another kind of nod to Elmore Leonard. And I'm hoping that every book I write will just have a little... If you're an Elmore Leonard fan, you'll find something in there that tips the nod to him.
Now, finally, why are you here supporting RNIB?
Well, I think for the reasons I've outlined, I think everyone should have access to everything that's available, music, writing, you know, film, anything that's out there should be available. And so I was kind of rather thrilled to be asked, and also to challenge my own perceptions as well, to suddenly look into something that I didn't really know a great deal about. You know, I know just on a very small personal level, because in the last 5 or 6 years I've had to start using reading glasses to read, and what you said earlier on about, I know how important that is to me, and I'm aware that these changes are happening outside with my control, within my body and stuff like that. And so it just, when I got asked about it, it just kind of touched a little nerve in a funny way. So I'm very pleased to be here.
Fantastic. John Gordon Sinclair, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online, or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
And finally, on today's show, here at Read On, we're excited about the Booker shortlist that was announced the other day. Fingers crossed we'll have all 6 authors on the show in the next few weeks. But for now, let's hear from a previous winner. Here's Red Sail with The Books of Your Life from 2019 winner Bernardine Evaristo.
Bernardine, was there a book that you read as a child that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I don't remember any book making me want to become an author, because I wasn't thinking about that at the time, but I wanted to be an actor and that was my first career. But the book that made perhaps the biggest impression on me is actually a radio play, Under Milkwood, by Dylan Thomas. And we did a production of it at school, which is how I was introduced to it. And I absolutely loved it. I loved the orality of it. I loved the characters, these kind of quirky characters. I loved the humor. I loved how he was able to convey this tiny little Welsh fishing village in a few words. And it was definitely later, I can see, the seminal influence on the kind of writing style that I would eventually develop.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat, there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush! The babies are sleeping. The farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobbler, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the web-foot cockle women and the tidy wives. Young girls lie bedded soft or glide in their dreams with rings and trousseau, bridesmaided by glowworms down the aisles of the organ-playing wood. The boys are dreaming wicked, or of the bucking ranches of the night and the jolly rogered sea, and the anthracite statues of the horses sleep in the fields, and the cows in the byres, and the dogs in the wet-nosed yards, and the cats nap in the slant corners, or lope sly, streaking and needling on the one cloud of the roofs. You can hear the dew falling, and the hushed town breathing. Only your eyes are unclosed to see the black and folded town fast and slow asleep. And you alone can hear the invisible starfall, the darkest before dawn minutely dew-gray stir of the black, dab-filled sea, where the Arethusa, the Curlew, and the Skylark, Zanzibar, Rhiannon, the Rover, the Cormorant, and the Star of Wales tilt and ride. Listen. It is night moving in the streets, the processional salt slow musical wind in Coronation Street and Cockle Row. It is the grass growing on Llareggub Hill, dewfall, starfall, the sleep of birds in Milkwood. Look, it is night dumbly, royally winding through the coronation cherry trees, going through the graveyard of Bethesda with winds gloved and folded and dewed oft, tumbling by the sailor's arms. Time passes. Listen. Time passes. Come closer now. Only you can hear the houses sleeping in the streets in the slow, deep, salt and silent black bandaged night. Only you can see in the blinded bedrooms the combs and petticoats over the chairs, the jugs and basins, the glasses of teeth, thou shalt not on the wall, and the yellowing dicky bird watching pictures of the dead. Only you can hear and see behind the eyes of the sleepers the movements and countries and mazes and colors and dismays and rainbows and tunes and wishes and flight and fall and despairs and big seas of their dreams. From where you are, you can hear their dreams.
Under Milkwood by Dylan Thomas is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB20490, which is narrated by Richard Burton and Sean Phillips. Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
So many books. I think I'm going to go for Ben Okri, The Famished Road. He won the Booker, of course. I think it was in 1991. Nigerian writer. And I don't remember much about the novel, to be honest. I read it once, but I absolutely loved it. And I remember the sensation of reading something that to me was so extraordinarily brilliant, I couldn't put it down. I was in awe of his prose style, of his imagination, of his ability to convey this Nigerian spirit world that he writes about. And I'd like to revisit it and see what I think today.
In the beginning, there was a river. The river became a road, and the road branched out to the whole world. And because the road was once a river, it was always hungry. In that land of beginnings, spirits mingled with the unborn. We could assume numerous forms. Many of us were birds. We knew no boundaries. There was much feasting, playing, and sorrowing. We feasted much because of the beautiful terrors of eternity. We played much because we were free. And we sorrowed much because there were always those amongst us who had just returned from the world of the living. They had returned inconsolable for all the love they had left behind, all the suffering they hadn't redeemed, all that they hadn't understood, and for all that they had barely begun to learn before they were drawn back to the land of origins. There was not one amongst us who looked forward to being born. We disliked the rigors of existence, the unfulfilled longings, the enshrined injustices of the world, the labyrinths of love, the ignorance of parents, the fact of dying, and the amazing indifference of the living in the midst of the simple beauties of the universe. We feared the heartlessness of human beings, all of whom are born blind, few of whom ever learn to see. Our king was a wonderful personage who sometimes appeared in the form of a great cat. He had a red beard and eyes of greenish sapphire. He had been born uncountable times and was a legend in all worlds, known by 100 different names. It never mattered into what circumstances he was born. He always lived the most extraordinary of lives. One could pore over the great invisible books of lifetimes and recognize his genius through the recorded and unrecorded ages. Sometimes a man, sometimes a woman, he wrote incomparable achievements from every life. If there is anything common to all of his lives, the essence of his genius, it might well be the love of transformation and the transformation of love into higher realities. With our spirit companions, the ones with whom we had a special affinity, we were happy most of the time because we floated on the aquamarine air of love. We played with the fauns, the fairies, and the beautiful beings, tender sibyls, benign sprites, and the serene presences of our ancestors were always with us, bathing us in the radiance of their diverse rainbows. There are many reasons why babies cry when they are born, and one of them is the sudden separation from the world of pure dreams, where all things are made of enchantment, and where there is no suffering.
The Famished Road by Ben Okri is available in a full range of accessible formats from the library, including as TB9219, narrated by Ben Onukwe. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I read Ghost Wall by Sarah Moss recently, and it's a very short book, but my God, it packs a punch. I don't want to say too much about it because I don't want to give anything away, but it's about a girl whose father is a sort of Iron Age enthusiast, and he takes his daughter and his wife to a remote part of the country to kind of reenact an Iron Age way of living. And through this, we get a sense of how people lived during the Iron Age. But there's so much going on with that book, and it's thrilling and it's shocking. It brings the Iron Age alive in some ways, but it's also about a guy who wants to feel a sense of belonging to a Britain before immigration. But of course, that's not true because Britain has always been settled by immigrants. So that's also something in the book. But it's also about her relationship with her father and her mother and some other people who get involved in this Iron Age reenactment. And I think it's a really magical book.
They bring her out. Not blindfolded, but eyes widened to the last sky, the last light. The last cold bites her fingers and her face. The stones bruise her bare feet. There will be more stones before the end. She stumbles. They hold her up. No need to be rough. Everyone knows what is coming. From deep inside her body, from the cord in her spine and the wide bloodways under the ribs, from the emptiness of her womb and the rising of her chest, she shakes. A body in fear. They lead the fearful body over the turf and along the track, her bare feet numb to most of the pain of rock and sharp rushes. Chanting rises. The drums sound slow, unsyncopated with the last panic of her heart. Others follow, wrapped against the cold, dark figures processing into the dusk. On arrival, they strip her. It is easy. They've put her into a loose tunic. Against the low red light of the winter sunset, her body is white as chalk, solid against the wisps of fog and the tracery of reed. She tries to cover herself with her hands and is not allowed. One holds her while the other binds her. Her breathing is accelerated, its condensation settling on her face. Exhaled breaths hang like spirits above each person's head, slowly dissolving into the air. The men turn her to face the crowd. They display her to her neighbours and her family, to the people who held her hands as she learnt to walk, taught her to dip her bread in the pot and wipe her lips, to weave a basket and gut a fish. She's played with the children who now peep at her from behind their mothers, has murmured prayers for them as they were being born. She has been one of them, ordinary.
Ghost Wall by Sarah Moss is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Christine Hewitt. Bernardine Evaristo, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for today's show. I'll be back at the same time next week with more book news, reviews and author interviews. And remember, you can join me every day of the week on Talking Books. First at 7 in the morning, then there's A Different Tale on at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. I can be found on Twitter at talking_books. So farewell until next week and remember to read on.